the show.
Well, hello everyone and welcome to this week's show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson. Very pleased to be here recording our first taping of 2012 here in the Boundless Studio after a good break with some travel in between. Want to welcome Martha Beck from Hawaii. Martha, welcome.
Aloha.
Aloha. She's now going to give us like 2 weeks here and then she's moving back to Hawaii apparently. So right. We'll keep you updated on her progress. So I haven't finished all the chocolate covered macadamia nuts yet.
Oh, I can help you out if you need.
I brought them home. I was like, that was not a good idea because I just have them on my counter and I just walk by, pick one up. So she brought me back that and some coffee, which was very exciting. Also at the table is Jeremy Woodard. Jeremy, welcome.
Hi.
Good to have you.
I want to go to Hawaii.
What? I know. But you've been, so we don't need to talk to you about that. I have not yet been. So
you haven't?
No, it's on my bucket list. So wow. I know. I want to go. I'm gearing up for a trip to Disney World. I'm just, because
it's close.
To which Dave, our engineer, told me when I was referencing this, because I'm going with a friend of mine, he's like, what are you, 12? Which is very rude. And I said, no, I'm going to be one of those single women that just like tools around and collects pins from the parks.
Nice.
Like just totally. That's okay. I'm not ashamed. Not ashamed. So Andrew Hess, welcome.
Good to be here.
Very glad to have you. For our fun discussion today, we've got a good show. Candace Waters later in the show, she's back. So Martha announced that already on Facebook with her column and contributing to inboxes. So very excited about that. And then for our culture segment, we have got Mark Driscoll. I was just there talking to him in Seattle. So part one of that interview will be coming up. So I know you guys have been anticipating that. So very fun. This week's show is actually sponsored by ChristianCafe.com. You all should know who that is at this point from our blog and beyond. So make sure you go to our page and you can access ChristianCafe.com from there. And if you enter the code Boundless, you will be able to get 4 extra days free on your membership. So okay, today's roundtable is going to be it started out being a little more streamlined and now it's hodgepodge-ish because we chose to believe and the Denver Broncos won the game this weekend against the Pittsburgh Steelers.
They did. Awesome. Go Broncos.
Exactly. And this is where I have to break into, there can be miracles if you
sing
believe.
It, Lisa.
Yeah, angels in the end zone.
So, I don't even know about football. I don't follow football. I don't even understand football, but this may be my entree back into the sport. So we'll see. Yeah. This may be maybe my last, next Saturday I'll watch the game as well.
I think it's the amazing thing about Tebow is all of the people that say they never have watched the NFL and now are watching the Broncos.
Yeah,
people that
there's Martha.
Yeah, all of a sudden Tebow is something to be exciting about.
Yeah. So. 'Cause he's pretty excited.
No, I watched the single NFL like when Joe Montana played for the 49ers and Steve Young, but that was only because Steve Young was attractive. So really that was my last time. I just do not follow football. Wow. It all looks the same to me. But now, Tebow, I think it is the personality. Like when you have a personality to latch on to.
Is that what they call it?
Yeah. I mean, when you have a person.
You can't even really see him under all that gear. So.
The human interest element of this is what matters to me.
Yeah. Do you think if he was married that he'd be demand this kind of attention?
I don't know. I think so. I mean, I think it's just the whole, I mean, certainly among evangelicals, I think that's playing into it a lot. Just the whole.
And his character and just who he is and his family and just beautiful. And
it's just beautiful.
Wow. That summarizes it pretty well. Yep.
That's, you know, like Martha blogged about cooking. She's going to start cooking. She's going to find out what Tim's favorite meal is and make it for him.
Mm-hmm. There you
I'm
go.
Just kidding.
You are.
But yeah. I already have hard enough time.
It's okay.
To do that.
It's okay to love Tebow.
I know. So it's all good. But so it's funny just to see, I mean, especially here around the office, especially here in Colorado, how excited everyone is about this. Because people just went into this weekend not believing that the Denvers were going to pull it off. But they did.
Yeah.
And so it's just, I think, bringing in a whole base of fans.
Can we just hear that again, the Denvers?
Did I say the Denvers?
Yeah.
Oh, see, I didn't even know. The Broncos. Ever. The Denver
She's
Broncos.
New to this whole
I know.
NFL world.
It's not like I'm a sportscaster, okay? I don't have I have to get my facts straight and my different illustrations. So So that's exciting. So speaking of, it's kind of fun to have a little fun show here as we are in the new year, because we had thought originally of talking about reality TV, returning to reality TV, and having a discussion of another TV phenomenon known as The Bachelor. So we thought we would bring our perspectives to the table on this show, some of us having watched it in the past, some of us still following it, some of us having different opinions as to its value, I guess, culturally, spiritually, and otherwise. So this, I did not get to watch the premiere. I just caught, you know, a little bit, a couple of recaps and stuff. And this guy, Ben, he's the bachelor right now. He was one, I think it's kind of the pattern now to have the runner-up kind of type person or someone in that top pool end up being either the bachelor or the bachelorette for the next season. And it was interesting because I was at TV.com kind of reading their little summary. They've got some funny commentators. And they said, they refer to this as, "The Bachelor is an emotional horse race, a grand anthropological experiment that sets up the same rigidly controlled environment with the same consistent factors, whirlwind group travel, helicopter dates, tea lights, season after season, with dramatically different results each time. The unique experience of watching two people meet and consider an intimate relationship provokes an initial judgment based on our own experiences, and each episode shocks or affirms us in how it fulfills our understanding of relationship dynamics." Okay, that kind of is a little bit overblown, I think, for what this show, show actually is. Yeah. I mean, it's like, what is this? Like, actually a psychological experiment. But I think it is funny. This author goes on to explain how we all kind of bring our own experiences into the show. And you do, like we just said about football, start rooting for certain people and hoping for them, which I think is just colossally hilarious, given the fact that only one relationship in the history of the Bachelor franchise has actually made it to marriage and worked out. Hmm. Now, there have been other matches in other reality TV shows and other people have gotten married, but the purpose of the show was not marriage. Hmm. So anyway, who... All of us have seen The Bachelor.
A little bit.
Okay.
Yeah. I even preparing for today, I watched a little bit. I watched the introduction to this season where they described kind of what you just said, mm-hmm. Ben. So, but I'm probably limited on like knowing trivia about season by season.
That is tragic.
More episode Twitter. That,
yeah. I go the other way because, let's be honest, didn't the Melissa, the one that dumped Melissa, he got married. So that's the second one, right?
Are they still married?
Yeah.
Oh, right. Right. Okay, yeah. So, but it wasn't like the one that he picked. So right. That was another one. Okay, yeah. They are married.
They
okay,
are married.
And Jason and Molly.
Yeah.
Okay. Bless their hearts.
I'm glad that you know their names.
I know. Well, that one I followed. Okay, I'm gonna be honest. I watched a few seasons of it. So haven't kept up with it recently. But Jeremy, you have Bachelor parties at your house.
Yeah, I want to blame my wife, but I still watch it, so...
Yeah. So I watched a season with you guys, at least. I went over on Monday nights and watched it, and it was really fun because we would all cook dinner and then watch the show, and basically we had nicknames for every person, mm-hmm. all the finalists, and then whenever they'd come on, you'd like shout out their nickname, and we basically would just, you know, pick out everyone's quirks and wonder why they were still on the show and
right.
kind of try to do our own little psych experiments.
And the
people.
Nicknames are rarely positive unless you like the person. Yeah.
That's very true. And we'd basically assume whether or not they were on the show for the right reasons and how all that played out and who was, you know, who were the gold diggers and who were the spotlight seekers and all of that. So, mm-hmm. Martha, you've seen The Bachelor.
I have seen past seasons and okay. the past few years I've had my small group on Monday night, so I've been out of the loop a little bit. Mm-hmm. So, and this year I just kind of thinking I probably won't watch. Mm-hmm. So,
are you disappointed with Ben?
I don't even know much about Ben, but I do get more emotionally involved of like these are real people, and I mean, it's all weirdly fake in some ways, but these are real people. Like, that's just kind of weird.
Yeah. Which prompts the question, who do you think, I mean, do you think any of these people are on there at this point? I mean, I think some of these shows, when they start, they kind of start with a good premise of people saying, hey, you know, this maybe is a great opportunity for me to meet great people and have fun in the process. But I think now people have gotten so jaded that it's like everyone is assumed to just be seeking fame or trying to launch some kind of, you know, broadcasting career or something weird or whatever. I don't know. What do you guys think?
I go with the latter on that one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I don't think just anyone's aiming to win. I think everyone's aiming to become runner-up so they become the next Bachelor.
Yeah.
Huh. That way you're more famous and you get paid a few hundred thousand.
Right.
Interesting.
That's true. And you get to be in control. Mm-hmm. You get to decide from there what you do. So,
So do you think the tears are fake?
I think that there are extremely emotional people in the world, and so
okay,
maybe
that's
but
true because there are tears.
Not.
Oh yeah, the first week—that's what gets me. It's like
I don't understand.
You don't
that.
Even know this guy. I don't know.
We call them desperate.
Well, okay.
Well, and again, it's amazing how this show is edited because you hear people talk afterwards, and they're always amazed that he would be indicating interest to someone else. And I'm like, seriously, because, you know, we get to see every angle of every relationship and stuff. And then people are like, oh, I just can't even believe that, you know, he was kissing her at like week four. And I'm like, the fact that he wasn't at week one is kind of, you know, because it seems to be what happens. And so it's just amazing what they're not seeing or what they're not experiencing. And they really think it's all about them. I just don't understand that. I mean, Andrew, I know you have kind of some concerns about the phenomenon of a show like this.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and I haven't watched it, so I have to be careful, and you guys can correct me if I misrepresent the show. But
oh, we will.
But, I mean, it seems to me that, I mean, a lot of my Christian friends, you know, I have a lot of friends who are, you know, women and who, you know, they desire something very different than the way that the bachelor relationships form, but yet they do watch it and find it entertaining. And so that I've always just kind of challenge that disconnect where they'll say, oh, we would never want a relationship like that, but it's so entertaining to watch it. You know, it's so fun. I mean, they'll get together. And so I've always just thought that was just fascinating that from what I know of The Bachelor, there's very few mentions of faith. And maybe there have been, I don't know if there's been contestants who like,
they get kicked off right away.
Do they?
Yeah.
Yeah. So faith is obviously, they don't like that. And even just the idea that you have one person who has 25 options and is just engaging in intimate relationships with all these different people at the same time. And I think, like, on a macro level, I think it suggests that when we go for relationships, we should try to kind of get the best deal we can, that whether it's looks or character or whatever, that you're just basically trying to get the best deal that you can get with your combination of looks, character, personality, emotion, whatever. And so to me, that kind of, I've always just thought that, especially for women, I think that's one of the things that they're so sensitive to is they don't want guys who are just shopping around, you know, that they want guys who are attracted to their heart. And so correct me, but it seems like The Bachelor completely misses that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and what's interesting is you don't get to see a lot of what prompts the selection process on the front end, other than you're looking for people that are hot and available and maybe quirky and talkative. I mean, some of them, or have some kind of freakish, you know, thing that's going to make the show be watchable.
Sure.
But all you really know about these people is their profession and their age, and then what you find out about them on the show. So you never find out if there's any elements of compatibility or what goes through in screening, you know, on the front end. So I think that is a little bit weird and a little bit false in that sense.
There's a lot of liquor too. Don't forget that.
That is very true.
And
that's the other thing is I just think it's so ridiculous how they even thought that you're supposed to get to an engagement at the end of this season, because really you're thrown. I mean, anyone who's thrown in Bora Bora in a resort, you know, with someone else. I mean, it's just such a false experience.
Do.
The whole. Well, I know that was your experience, yeah. Jeremy. I mean, obviously.
Take me to Bora Bora. Yeah. I will say
You'll
yes.
marry anyone.
Yes. Especially Tebow.
Right. That's very true. So it just seems it seems that it is funny. But Andrew, I understand what you're saying, because I think it is a little bit of a, we tend to give ourselves a pass when we think of entertainment versus what do we really support in the sense of, you know, cheering these people on or thinking it's okay or putting a stamp of approval on it.
Well, I think it plays into just the whole fairy tale idea in romantic comedies. And I mean, girls are drawn to that from the time they're 4 years old. And I mean, hopefully you're wise about what love stories you're, you know, opening yourself up to. But I don't know. I think there's just something in us.
Yeah.
Can't explain.
Well, and again, and this is so, I mean, you guys are going to think, stretch. But we talked about football on the front end. This is like the girls' equivalent of picking someone that you want to root for and you feel like she's your girlfriend. So you always want to single out the girl next door person, the one who seems relatively normal, and then you cattily tear down all the other girls, and then you shout at the bachelor who cannot hear you, why aren't you paying attention to this girl? Why don't you like her? Why don't you? So we want to cheer for the girl that we think most closely represents us or our ideals or who we would be if we were there or whatever.
Yeah. I think that's a lot of reality TV is like that. Mm-hmm. You know, you pick out people that, whether it's The Amazing Race or, you know, Survivor or any of these other shows, you kind of feel drawn to certain people, and you want to see them succeed, and so you almost feel loss if they lose, and you feel excitement if they win, and so I think that's probably part of the draw.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so. I root for the train wreck. Is that bad? And there's more than enough this season, so
yeah. Well, and even it's kind of like you think in the past they've picked these guys as The Bachelor that are investment bankers. They've always been the type of kind of the classically, stereotypically assumed guys to be the quintessential bachelor. This guy, Ben, looks like, in fact, I think this writer at TV.com described like he should be sitting there with bongo drums or something. They basically said he just doesn't seem, he kind of seems like he's a college frat guy who just maybe stumbled into a career and kind of is like a loosey-goosey.
And mildly depressed. He kind of looks a little down all the time, doesn't he?
Yeah. And, and then it's the parade of women that are trying to sell themselves to him with whatever qualities they believe they have. So I think it is a little bit.
Did you see the where they do the at the end of The Bachelor, they show that next week or this season, expect this, and that one gal keeps going winning when she comes walking by. I thought that was hilarious.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Well, she's not there for the right reasons. Right.
Yeah, those who were there for the right reasons. Mm-hmm. But it really is setting yourself up. I mean, a number of the sites that I was looking at, they pick people apart. Like one girl, they had a like a framed out view of her hair, and it was just kind of messy, and so they're like, get a hairdresser, and so now she's going to be lambasted because her hair doesn't look good, and everyone else, it's just like nitpicking everyone apart. And there is no way I would do that show ever. This is why we're an audio show, folks, because I cannot pull myself together that often. So they have teams of whatever, but still.
Yeah. And one question I'd have for you guys that watch it more regularly is, do you think that, you can watch the show and not be impacted by it as far as kind of the way that The Bachelor suggests relationships can start? Because I would probably tend to think that if you watch The Bachelor a lot, like you take a typical Christian woman who is waiting for her Prince Charming to come along, or just a man. If she watches The Bachelor a lot, is some of the things that she sees on The Bachelor could it impact her heart, or do you feel like that people are just kind of watching it very much unaffected by it?
I think that's true of all entertainment where people think it doesn't affect them. But the repetition, I think it does settle in your mind somewhere. I mean, even the beauty aspect of thinking, okay, I need to be that size and have that hair color. And I think, it sinks in.
Mm-hmm. Though I think for me, what is actually, encouraging, and I say this it's in a bad way, for women, is that you can look at these 25 women and say, oh my word, you can be a size zero and beautiful and whatever. And none of these women have found love. They are on this show parading themselves in front of a guy, hoping to be loved and hoping to be picked. And I think that is a great cultural commentary on where we are in the consumeristic nature of how we move into relationships and marriage, and just how completely at sea most people are in how to get there.
Sometimes there's like single moms on there, or divorced, or widowers. So
it is kind of a mixed bag for sure. But I think for me, it's more of the fact that I am entering into a story that does not affect me. It's not part of my life. I'm not in these people's lives. They're not in mine. So I think for me, the decision was, wow, this could be just a colossal waste of my time, and I need to separate myself from it. So it's not so much being influenced by the content of it as just... What really shakes me up every time I see it is just when they do the previews, and it's so the effort is to be, make it so scintillating, like dun dun dun, you know, yeah. Like here's what happens in the finale, and then you just agonize for like 5 weeks until the
most
finale.
Dramatic.
Exactly. Yeah. And
time.
He's like the guy's like hanging over the balcony in tears, and you're like, what is happening to him? And it's like, why do I? I have people in my life that I need to care about what is happening to them, not about this guy that I will never meet, that I will never, you know. So I think there are other, you know, and obviously there are a lot of critics of reality TV in general, but I think that there is something fun in like an Amazing Race and watching what happens there and seeing the different locales or a, you know, cash cab. I mean, whatever, you can learn some trivia, you can see it's kind of fun. I'm just like, I want to be in Manhattan and get in the cash cab, you know, whatever. But to enter into something that I think is, you know, more playing on people's emotions or on their stories or something could be a little sketchy.
So I'm not going to be as godly. I think it's high entertainment value. And yes, maybe people are impacted. But as a married man, embarrassing that I watch it. Yeah. Anyways, I enjoy it because it's high entertainment value. Yeah. That's it. And I find exactly what you were saying before, Lisa, on it's like sports. You end up rooting for your two or three people that you want to see advance.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And every so often, mine all get, you know, dinged out within the third or fourth round. And
the bummer is they never make it. These relationships never make it. So you just invested 13 weeks and it's like, oh, they just went their own ways. You know, after the show, they made it 2 weeks and then.
Yeah, but you're not watching it for whether or not they make it long term. It's if they make it in the show, it's kind of like the entertainment value of the Kardashians, which I don't watch. I imagine other people enjoy that. You can't tell me that that's reality TV. So, you know.
That's true. Yeah. But we have, like, Jeremy and his wife and some others and I had a season of watching, like, So You Think You Can Dance. Mm-hmm. Now, that to me was interesting because I'm like, oh, my word, these people can dance. This is something I never could do. And I was, it's like, that is amazing. That's, like, actually some skill and some talent. And I'm like, wow, that's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. And it has their own little drama in it, too, but still, you know.
I don't think you can compare that to The Bachelor, though.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, really, I mean, toward the end of the season of The Bachelor and Bachelorette, I really get sick to my stomach just with the hot tub scenes. And then they have these overnight dates. Mm-hmm. And I mean, these are real people. This is not just a drama going on here.
Like, right. Right.
I don't.
Well, I agree. I don't see. And totally. That's what I think that's like the producer, because I don't think, and I don't know, maybe I'm wrong in this or whatever. Maybe someone knows these people and they can get the behind the scenes scoop. But I don't think stuff happens in that overnight date. What bothers me is that the producers set it up like it does. And so they just make it sound so. I don't know. I just think I think all these, you know, have, it's not like these people really probably have a huge moral compass anyway. Not that maybe they wouldn't do whatever.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I just think it's so salaciously told in that sense. But that's what I'm saying. I was trying to compare the two to say, one, actually, we're talking about people competing with bona fide skills, like people that can do real stuff.
Yeah.
Other people are just drinking Mai Tais and prostituting themselves to get picked for something. So I don't know. I just see it. But, you know, entertainment or whatever. We'll see. All right. Good discussion. Let us know. I would love to hear what our international listeners think. I mean, obviously, you can get this, you know, on the internet, these shows and stuff. But do y'all follow this, or do you have equivalents in your own countries of people that are just wrapped up in this stuff, whether sports or whether reality TV, or are y'all just out doing something worthwhile 24/7? We'll see. Maybe they'll be like, you Americans are disasters. But thanks, you guys.
Because of The Bachelor.
But I know,
right?
It's our,
that's
it pretty much summarizes us. So thanks, you guys, for the discussion.
I come to the garden alone while the dew is still on the roses. And the voice I hear falling on my ear, the Son of God discloses. He speaks, and the sound of his voice is so sweet, the birds hush their singing, and the melody that he gave to me within my heart is ringing, and he walks with me, and he talks with me, and he tells me I am his own, and the joy we share as we tarry there, none other has
As you know, I had the privilege of traveling last week to Seattle to interview Pastor Mark Driscoll and his wife, Grace. Mark is one of today's leading influencers of Christian young adults, a major voice in the culture, and an occasionally controversial figure due to his style of preaching, among other things. Mark and Grace released their new book, Real Marriage, last week, and it's already at the top of the bestseller lists. The book itself has generated a lot of discussion and has prompted some evangelical leaders, bloggers, and reviewers to take issue with portions of it. At the top of the I'm Not Sure About This list is Chapter 10, a chapter titled Can We Blank? Mark and Grace wrote it as a response to the many questions they receive from married couples and singles on the topic of sex. It's a frank discussion of a number of sexual acts and related issues that, in the context of the book, Mark and Grace put through a scriptural grid to determine their validity within a healthy sexual relationship. While I did talk to Mark and Grace about this chapter, we've decided to edit out that portion of the interview for the show. We don't want to offend those who may take issue with the discussion of somewhat explicit topics and feel that those who want to know Mark's take on them will read the book and form their own conclusions. That portion of the interview was very small, and removing it doesn't detract from the rest of the discussion. What you'll hear in my interview with Mark and Grace is what you'd expect from Boundless, a thorough discussion of their story, plus themes of friendship, masculinity, communication, and other topics. I interviewed Mark and Grace on the day of the book's release, and this interview is one of the first out of the gate. That said, Boundless and Focus on the Family are not offering this interview as an endorsement of the book. We understand, and in some cases share, the reservations that many have concerning it and respect those fully. But you come to Boundless to hear frank discussions by respected leaders on what's happening in our culture. So here we are. Enjoy the conversation and let us know what you think. Well, hey, everyone. We are here for this week's culture segment, and I am very privileged to be in Seattle in person across the table from Mark and Grace Driscoll. Welcome to both of you.
Cool. Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, now I have to be honest, it's not everyone that we just travel to random cities to see. Okay, you guys are at the top of the list among a few, select few, that we know that we want to talk to, especially now in 2012. Our people, I was telling you this before we started taping, our listeners love you, follow you, have read your stuff, have listened to your sermon series. Grace, you're just going to have to start writing more so we can, you know, you can just eclipse Mark, whatever, it's just a matter of time, you know, we'll see. No, we won't encourage that. But you are on the heels of the brand new release of Real Marriage, your book. We are, in fact, one of your first interviews, I think, and really, quite frankly, the most important one.
Absolutely. Right. That's why we put you first.
Yes. Well, that's what we feel. It will go downhill from here, but you're going to at least be off to a bang. That is good. I'm going to give you guys the chance to speak frankly to our audience on stuff that really many of us have thought about, because we are passionate at Boundless about marriage. We're passionate about young adults. We're passionate about moving young adults towards family, towards marriage, believing that it really is part of God's design. The Bible begins with marriage and it ends with marriage. Talks about marriage a lot in between. So, but I want to just start off by asking, a lot of people may say, especially when you kind of kick off the book and you start telling some of your own story, what business do you guys have talking about marriage? Because you had a rocky start. Yeah. And some people are going to be like, you know, did you learn anything? How did this happen?
Yeah, I think part of it is it's like asking a sinner, what right do you have to talk about grace? It's like, well, they may actually know the most because they've experienced the most. For us, we did start with sin and some things that were wrong, and it had tremendous negative effects on the early years. We were faithful to one another. We were in church. We were reading the Bible. We were praying. And I think one of the myths that we held is, you know, you can have things not be so great, but once you get married, then everything kind of resets and you're going to be okay. And we hadn't worked through a lot of the stuff from our past, sins we'd committed and sins that have been committed against us. And so those really affected the early years of the marriage. And so I know a lot of your audience is single, and I think sometimes that same myth is still fairly common. Like, yeah, well, I'm single now, but as soon as I get married, you know, things will change and all change and the past will be the past and we'll move forward. And sometimes you bring the baggage and the carry-ons with you, and I think we did that.
Yeah. So would you say, if you were talking to singles now, what are some things specifically that you probably could have done differently that would have set you off on a better foot? Mm.
I think just being able to be honest with someone that you trust, whether it's a pastor or a friend that has wisdom, that's maybe a few more years ahead. Just being able to be honest and repent of things and also talk about sins that have been done against you. We didn't know how to process those things and didn't surround ourselves later in our, or early in our marriage with people that could help us with that. And I think had we started to do that, it would have opened up better conversation between Mark and I just to even enter into our relationship and get to know each other. It's it's hard to get to know each other when there's secrets or when you haven't discussed certain pain in the past.
Yeah, and for us as well, I think a big part of it was I didn't have any teaching and she had very little teaching. I didn't get saved until college. And I think our story is fairly common for a lot of people today, even those who grow up in Christian homes. Statistically, by college in those single years, they're out, especially the men. And then they'll come to Christ or come back to Christ, but usually with some things they regret having done. And so we felt if we were honest in the book, it might be of service and help to those who, like us, don't have the, you know, I grew up in a Christian home and won the Bible Trivia Bowl and, you know, kept my purity ring on until I got married in my late 30s. You know, there's
a
few of those.
That's my story.
Yeah, well, you could have a conference in a phone booth. There's just not a lot of you, you know,
okay.
So.
Wow, okay.
I mean, it's pretty rare today to make it through your singles just clean and loving Jesus with a boring testimony.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly. Well, speaking of which, so you guys actually started out dating in what was really, you know, by the book, an unequally yoked relationship. Grace, you being a believer, pastor's daughter, and Mark, you know, we know a little bit of your story. You just said didn't become a believer till college. And the relationship was sexual. Now, Grace, you had said that you had strayed kind of from the Lord during your teen years.
Yes.
What do you think? I mean, we hear about that so much. I mean, the kids, Gen X and millennials, products of the 80s and 90s, are doing that or have done that. They didn't grow up with a solid foundation of faith in their home. What would you say you attribute your kind of departure or wandering from the faith to?
I had a very simple faith, and I didn't study and pursue my relationship with Jesus like I should have. Even in a pastor's home, when everybody's busy ministering to everyone else, that doesn't always get done in the home, unfortunately. And so I think for me, it was partly my own neglect in my relationship. And so then I went into high school and was very easily swayed by all of the non-believers around me and chose to walk in sin in those years. And I didn't see that as my fault for a long time and wanted to blame shift that. But I know that God provided other ways for me to walk, but I just didn't choose to do that. So I think it both my pursuit of my relationship, that I know I had a relationship with Jesus, but it was just so basic that I didn't know how to deal with the realities of life and the pressures of life when they started coming in high school. And so that's when I started to make sinful decisions that were destructive.
Yeah, and I think, too,
and it endangered me in my relationships with other people.
Yeah, you were in dangerous positions. And I think there's a difference between innocence and naivety. Now that we're parents, we talk a lot about this. You want to raise kids who are innocent, but sometimes in Christian homes, you can raise kids who are naive, meaning they haven't gotten into trouble, but it's not because they're smart and wise and discerning, but because they've been sheltered. And the result is once that sheltering's over, and it might be high school or off to college or into the single years, particularly if a woman is more naive, I think she's in a very dangerous, vulnerable position. And I think, you know, my perspective now as a daddy with two daughters is that was part of Grace's story as well. She didn't, I mean, she was in very dangerous situations and didn't even see them as dangerous.
Yeah. Now, Mark, you said that several years, or you described several years into your marriage having a vision of Grace sinning sexually with someone in high school not long after you guys started dating. And you said that basically had you known that going into marriage, you probably wouldn't have married her. But at the same time, you guys were sinning sexually. So isn't that kind of a, you know, for those who would say, hey, that's a double standard. What's your response to that?
Probably so.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's, I think that's probably very accurate that I had expectations, you know, that could easily, you know, be hypocritical. And so, And I think it's the same way with singles today. I was preaching to some singles this last weekend. I said, you know, how many of you have got a list for what you're looking for in a spouse? And almost everybody raised their hand. I said, how many of you have a list of what you want to be for your spouse? And nobody raised their hand. You know, I knew what I wanted, and I was far more concerned about who I was going to marry than who I was going to be for Grace. And that was sin that God convicted me of. And over the course of our marriage, she's continuing to convict me of, to love her like Christ loves the church, which means to give and to care and not just to take and to judge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Grace, in your sexual relationship, I know before marriage, Mark described you as free and fun, but afterwards he described you as frigid and fearful. Why the change? What kind of switch flipped there?
Well, for me, shame was a lot of what was going on. Just knowing that there had been sins against me with an abusive relationship before I met Mark, and then moving into marriage, knowing that I had sinned with Mark, it really did a number on, I guess, my heart and my trying to understand how sex could be okay, because it had been in such a wrong context the previous times. And so I really didn't know how to work through how it could be okay. I knew God says it was, he created it, he said it was good. But I didn't understand practically what that meant in our marriage after all that I had been through and we had been through. I didn't know how to sort through the darkness of sinful sex.
Yeah, and for me, having come to faith later, it was, well, I didn't know that this was wrong, and now I know that this is wrong, and now, you know, we're going to stop, and we're going to get married, and we're going to do it God's way. And so I didn't have the same level of shame. But because she
kind of just thought it was a clean slate, so
yeah, like, well, I just became a Christian and I'm learning a lot and things got to change, and you know, I'm going to make those changes. And but for her, having grown up a Christian and gotten certain teaching and knowledge of what was right and wrong, you know, I think it was hard for you to process the gospel for yourself, that forgiveness, identity in Christ, you know, clean, made new. I think that was hard for you to personally figure out how that worked for you.
Yeah, it transferred into a lot of different areas, the lack of freedom. It wasn't just in the bedroom. I didn't feel freedom in many areas in my life because of shame in general. I didn't, even though I knew the gospel, I didn't understand it for myself, like you're saying. And so I just felt like somehow I had to make up for all the wrong things that I had done, which is penance, which isn't the gospel at all. It's not grace that God gives to us. So I really, God had to show me what that meant in the future years after that.
Yeah. Hmm. Okay. Now, you guys talk a lot about the importance of friendship in marriage. And I think for singles, this is pretty puzzling because it's hard for us to envision in our romanticized view of marriage that that could ever become stale. Oh my goodness, I'm just going to love this person. We're going to hang out. We're going to go rollerblading and go to movies all the time. And it's going to be so amazing. What would you say are the warning signs that really, I mean, moving into a marriage, we hear about a lot of people eventually just they're coexisting. You know, what do singles and newly married folks need to have in place to really understand the importance of friendship?
Well, I mean, I think that you do need to know how to have fun together. And for Mark and I, there was a lot of things that were done wrong, the one thing that we did do to try and maintain some sort of fun in the relationship was to keep our date night, and every Friday was our date night. Even when we started the church, everybody knew, do not contact us on Friday, we're on a date, that's our time, and we could count on that. I think in some ways that helped us survive even as nominally as we did, and and so I think putting things into place that are regular, that keep you in connection, because life gets busy, life gets crazy, whether it's tasks, responsibilities, job, people, mm-hmm. It doesn't matter. It can easily take over a friendship in your marriage. And so making sure that that stays a priority, and whether it's date night or regular meetings at night where you're having face-to-face conversation, or just making sure that that's a priority.
And our experience, tragically, is there are very few pastors I know who I think they have a good friendship with their wife. I know that's very controversial. Even in the Reformed, complementarian, Bible-believing, check all the boxes, you see them with their spouse, it's not warm, it's not affectionate, it's not tender, they don't laugh a lot, they're not having a lot of fun, and their sins tend to be not sins of commission, like adultery or battering, but sins of omission. They're not cherishing, enjoying, making memories. And so then what holds it together is the kids, the grandkids, and the ministry. And they'll just throw themselves headlong into that world, which then those things that are good become idols. And they're a place to hide from, you know, real intimacy with Jesus and intimacy with your spouse, friendship with Jesus, friendship with your spouse. You know, and that was one of the things that really sort of shocked us is as we started talking to certain people who, you know, all kinds of theological tribes and denominations, you know, the marriage experts or the book writers or the counselors, you know, just asking, you know, what counsel would you give us and how could we have a better marriage? As we got to know a lot of these couples, it was pretty scary, mm-hmm. What we saw. And it would never get them fired, but it's gonna not make them old and happy and holding hands and being buddies.
Yeah.
It's real functional.
Yeah. Now you talk, Grace, you actually say some pretty hard things to women in the book about respect. And I think for a lot of women, especially single women, that's a fearful thing because we have a hard time envisioning and trusting ourselves to a man, fearful of what he'll do to our heart, fearful of who he is, will he change? And so I'm wondering, like a lot of us think, okay, you know, I think you even say in the book, don't marry a guy who you don't respect and who you can't follow or who you don't want to follow. But what if in marriage things change? What if he, you know, not that he's going to become a different person, but what's that difference between an earned respect and an unconditional respect? I think a lot of women struggle with that.
Well, I think sometimes it does seem like the men change once you get married. You wonder, wait a second. You both change. I mean, you put on your best foot forward.
You don't even know who you married till about year 5 to 7.
Okay.
And then one day you wake up and you're like, oh, this is who you are. Okay.
It's like the grab bag. I knew it was at the store. You're just like, it's the brown paper bag, whatever. Okay. More reasons why I'm still single. Okay. Got it. I'm going to write that down. Yeah.
So I think, I mean, going into it as women, we need to know what the scriptures ask of us. And it asks us to respect our husbands. It doesn't give conditions. Well, if he does this and if he does that, you get to respect him. It asks us to do that. It also coincides with the scriptures that ask the husband to love the wife as Christ loved the church. So it goes hand in hand, but yet we are responsible for our portion of it if we are disrespectful. So basically, you need to go into marriage knowing that that is what God has asked. And it's going to be a hard task because he's asked it. He wouldn't have even stated it if it was easy, probably. So knowing that, we're not always going to naturally respect our spouse. And so we have to choose to do that by God's grace. And marriage incorporates a ton of prayer, I think, from both sides, because I'm not always lovable, and I can attest to many times myself, and I'm sure he can attest to many more. And so he has to choose to love me, and he's grown in that, and I've grown in choosing to respect him. Does it mean that we have to have false respect or, you know, say things that aren't true just so that you puff up your husband so that he feels respected? Absolutely not. But you can start, and I think we talk about it in the book, you can start with the very basic of things where you're an encourager and you look at the things that you do respect. There's got to be at least one or two if you married the person. And start there and really encourage those things and pray that God would continue to grow those things in your husband. And he's been so faithful in that. And I've seen that in many, many, many marriages where God is just so faithful to encourage that in the spouse. And so for me, it's been hard and easy, both, you know, throughout the course of our marriage. And even though Mark does many things that are respectful, I have to learn how to come alongside that in a different way than I would have thought being single.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, too, for women, sometimes they think it means I can't have independent thoughts. Well, you're going to. I can't disagree. Well, you certainly will. And that's where I appreciate, even in the chapter, you put a whole section in there on disagreeing respectfully. Mm-hmm. So when you completely disagree, how do you even enter into those potential conflicts in a way that is still respectful, so that the issue remains the issue and it doesn't become adversarial? You're trying to attack the problem and not the person, as it were. So,
And ultimately, we're trusting God, because we can't always trust each other. We're going to fail each other. But God knows that, and God can make up for all the things that we do against each other to hurt each other, whether it's disrespect or unlove. And so I think we need to make sure our relationship is centered in Christ and asking the Lord to show us our own sin. And then if we're struggling with being disrespectful, I think as we build our friendship, we should be able to talk about that. This is a sin that I'm struggling with. Can you help me with this? How do I approach you differently so that you don't feel disrespected? Mm-hmm. That's a friendship. You should be able to be honest about that things over time.
Yeah. And I've heard a lot of great godly women talk about that, about how they're not their husband's Holy Spirit. You know, they can't step into that role. Mm-hmm. But what would you say, and maybe Mark, you can address this, for a woman who really is praying and is encouraging her husband, and he still is just a jerk, or he's foolish and making unwise decisions on behalf of his family? Does she have a recourse of going to a pastor or getting...
Absolutely, yeah, because the man is responsible for the well-being of his wife and children. I think that's what the Bible means when it repeatedly says that the man is the head of the household. But that doesn't mean he's the ultimate authority. I mean, over him are pastors and elders in the church. And, you know, above that is the law, if he's breaking the law. And above it all is the Lord. So she has other places to appeal to higher authority. And so if the man is misusing and abusing his authority and making stupid decisions or bankrupting the family or, you know, habitually unrepentant or just being harsh, whatever it is, yeah, I think it's absolutely reasonable for her to, you know, to speak with him. And if he's just not open or teachable, to then appeal to higher authority in the church. And that's where good godly men sit him down and are probably going to be a little more stern. They should be. And it should be guy to guy. And then the wife should not feel the pressure to come in and police her own husband. But other men should take that responsibility within the church. That's why the church family is so important. Because mm-hmm. yes. The worst is when a guy says, I'm the head of the home and I'm the boss, and he's not under authority, he's not in community, he's not in church, and all of a sudden he's a law unto himself and she's supposed to just submit to that. Mm-hmm. To me, that's a recipe for a really abusive, dangerous situation for the woman and for the children.
Yeah, or they're in a church where no one is going to go after him, where it's just a very passive kind of structure of how things are handled, which actually brings me to my next question. You guys quote Gary Thomas in the book saying, couples don't fall out of love so much as they fall out of repentance. And I think, I mean, when I read that, I'm like, wow, we hardly practice repentance in the church. You know, there's a lot of just, oh, well, let's overlook that, or let's just try to be friends with everyone, or let's just stay out of one another's lives so we don't have conflict. I mean, I think we're just doing that poorly in general. Yeah. So I think a lot of people go into marriage and they're like, okay, now I have to live this transparent life and be all honest with my spouse and repent and whatever, but they're just not even practiced at it.
Yeah.
So what can we do about that? How do we even start that in the church and then bring it into marriage and into relationships?
Yeah, and part of it is, it starts at the top with the leadership in the church. I mean, one of the reasons in the book I talk about my sin and our sin is it sets a culture of authenticity in the church, and it encourages people to just tell the truth. And what oftentimes happens is the pastor will preach repentance but not practice repentance. And so the pastor will talk about sin and everybody else's sin and cultural sin and examples and counseling appointments of somebody's sin. Never talks about their sin. And the result is it creates a very religious culture where the church, then we talk about, you know, institutional sins like racism or sexism or classism, where we talk about other people's sins, but we don't talk about our sin. And I think a lot of churches have that deep root of religiosity. And repentance then is what non-Christians do to become Christians, not what Christians do to grow as Christians. And that's antithetical to the whole Protestant Reformation. When Martin Luther nailed the 95 Theses to the Wittenberg door, the first line was, all of a Christian's life is one of repentance. You know, to be a Christian is to be a habitual repenter. And that trickles down into the church, developing a culture, and then that affects the marriage. We've had a lot of people come up to us and say, hey, thanks for telling us your story. Ours is just like that. And then the question is, well, you know, why is this the first time you've ever heard that there's trouble or sin or problems going into marriage? You know, I mean, if you've been in church and you've been under teaching, somebody giving a testimony or pastor giving a sermon, I mean, somebody should have said, you know, when the Bible talks about sin, it's also talking about us. Mm-hmm. And this is a place where we talk about our stuff and get the help we need by the grace of God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Grace, you talk a little bit in the book about marriages being affected by high incidences of past abuse. You have a chapter in there where you talk a lot about that, and you share your own story in that. And kind of what I've heard from folks on this is exactly what you describe, almost a sense of denial about it. Not even with the people that I talk to, not so much a sense that it never happened, but that talking about it now is going to make any difference. Why do you think it will? And what really is the place? Where should a person, a past victim of abuse, what should they eventually be able to acknowledge publicly, and how do they get to that place?
Well, I think bringing things into the light helps, because God is able to heal when it's in the light. And I think because the culture is doesn't talk about it, even in the Christian community, it's not widely discussed, and people aren't helped. There's a lot of shame involved with it. And so if we can remove the shame, because God doesn't shame us, he doesn't condemn us, especially for a sin that's been done against us. If we can move out of that shame, then it helps us be able to see our need for Jesus, and also that sins are done against us, but it doesn't have to completely cripple us for the rest of our life. And so I think for me, sharing that with people, we have a large percentage of women in the church that have experienced some sort of sexual assault.
If you just took, not to interrupt you, sweet, but 1 in 6 men and 1 in 3 women admits to being sexually assaulted, the numbers could be higher. And the younger you are, the higher the percentage. But if you just took all the women in our church who were sexually assaulted, raped, abused, I'd still pastor a mega church of 2,000 or more, just female rape victims. I mean,
it's horrendous. Yeah,
yeah, it's kind of the flip side of the porn culture is then predatory culture toward women. And to be a single woman today is to be in a really dangerous, vulnerable position. It really is. I mean, you're out on your own, usually in an urban environment, surrounded with a sea of men, and you don't know which ones are safe until sometimes you're in a dangerous situation. And that's kind of the reality of what we deal with all the time as a church. So we do redemption groups, and we had a pastor and his wife write Rid of My Disgrace, which is a book for sexual assault victims. And all of that came out of Grace's story. And once we finally connected some of the dots to what had happened in her past, realized that I wanted to have her get help and wanted to be able to help her, and then just kind of was made aware of a real epidemic in the culture and in the church that I think a lot of churches just are completely, quite frankly, ignorant of. I was talking to one well-known pastor with a good-sized church that, if I said his name, your listeners would know. And he said, why do you got to talk about rape and sexual assault and stuff? We're having lunch. And I said, well, it's a big issue at our church. He said, well, it's not at ours. We only have a couple people. I was like, no, you've not really sort of opened that conversation and tried to help the people who are there, because in a large church, there's more than a couple people who have been sexually assaulted, that's for sure.
And I think the lie is that if you've been sexually assaulted, you can just turn the page and you'll be fine and it won't affect your life. I've heard that over and over, and I believe that. That's why I didn't feel the need to share it. And so I think my goal in sharing the story is helping people understand that you don't need to live in shame of it, of what happened to you, but you also can be healed from it, and it doesn't need to cripple you. And so for me, that was the big goal, because it did cripple me and it did shame me, but bringing it into the light, as hard and as fearful as I was to do that at the time, God was so faithful to surround me with a community that helped me walk through that. And like you said, the redemption groups that we have are amazing. And even the thought of going into a group setting and talking about it terrified me. It seems easier to go to a counselor, and that's not a bad thing. But I thought, surely I can't talk about this with lots of people. But then when we were in the setting and everybody was talking about their experiences, it was so freeing, not because other people had been harmed, that was not a good thing, but it was freeing to know that I wasn't alone and that there was hope for all of us, because Jesus allows that. And so that was really my goal in sharing the story.
She was super brave. She's way more brave than me. She's the tough one.
Well, it reminds me of what people say about even death and divorce, how you will grieve these things at some point in your life. And if you stuff it initially, it will crop up somewhere else. And you have to be able to grieve what was done and work, you know, and like you said, name it and
bring
it into
the light. Yeah, have righteous anger and everything.
Yeah. It's good. Thank you guys both for just being willing to be so candid, really, in writing the book and in talking about it. I think it is just hugely, like I said, I mean, our audience is talking about these things, and I can just really see a true heart in you guys in communicating these things and being willing, especially to share from your own story, because that is, that's huge. I think there's this perception that people in ministry are in ministry because they have had perfect lives and perfect marriages and perfect ministries. So to see that that is not always the case gives us hope. So. You can find out more about Mark, of course, at pastormark.tv. You can also find him on Twitter and on Facebook. And like I said, we'll let you know when Grace's writing ministry and speaking ministry eclipses his.
Shortly.
Shortly. So thanks so much, you two.
I am thine, O Lord. I have heard thy voice, and it told thy love to me. But I long to rise in the arms of faith and be closer drawn to thee. Draw me nearer, nearer, blessed Lord, to the cross where thou hast died. Draw me nearer, blessed Lord, to thy precious bleeding side. There are depths of love that I cannot know till I cross the narrow sea. There are heights of joy that I may not reach till I rest in peace with thee. Draw me nearer, nearer, blessed Lord, to the cross where thou hast died. Draw me nearer, 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 blessed Lord, to thy precious bleeding.
Well, we are opening up this week's inbox, and I have Candace on the phone. Hey, Candace.
Hey, Lisa. How are you? Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. So glad you are back in the fray. Good to have you back
I'm
on the inbox.
Glad to be back in the fray.
I know. Very fun. And we are looking forward to seeing you next month. We're going to come out there for the Give Me an Answer conference, Martha and I. So it'll be good to have a little Boundless reunion.
Yeah, I wish we could come there, but this is still awesome. We can't wait to see you guys.
Yeah, it'll be fun. So
I hope to do some live interviews with you when you're here.
Exactly. Yeah, and stay tuned, everyone, because we will be bringing a show from the conference itself. So that'll be exciting to do from the very studios that Al Mohler sits in. So
yeah, and if anybody in Kentucky or Indiana or Ohio wants to come to the Radical Conference in February, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
There's still room, so they just need to log on to the sbts.edu website, and they could actually be here and meet Lisa. that would be pretty much awesome.
Speakers including Kevin DeYoung and David Platt. So
that's right.
That'll be great.
Yeah, it's going to be a good lineup. And Stephen Candace Waters.
Yes. So
little known.
That will be good.
We'll do a little breakout.
I know. Oh, that'll be great.
You might be surprised to hear that we'll be talking about dating and Christian dating.
You've
got to
be kidding me.
About dating.
Oh, my goodness. You better do a lot of prep on that in the front end so you know what you're talking about. Good. Well, speaking of which, you're going to be able to address a question right here on that very topic from a girl who says, I desire marriage, but I'm too shy to have a conversation with any young man. I can sit on Facebook for long periods of time looking at pictures of young men that I'm interested in, or I can sit across the same room and focus on him and come up with my own judgments of him without even ever having a healthy conversation with him. I know this is infatuation, and I know it's unhealthy, but what are we as young adults to do about it in a biblical manner?
Well, my short answer is stop it. All right, now I need to unpack that a little bit. I need to do full disclosure. I recently got off Facebook. Mm. I went in and canceled my account. And Lisa, I don't even know if I told you this. And Facebook doesn't make it easy to do. They want you to suppress it so you can always come back to it.
Right,
but they,
yes.
But they actually make you wait 2 weeks to really cancel it. And boy, that was a long 2 weeks of having a lot of second thoughts. But it was like a black hole on my time. And so I have now been off of Facebook for, 5 months, and hopefully I'm gaining some perspective. But to someone who is still so involved in it that she can spend, you know, countless time on it looking at guys, I'm just really concerned. I think at its best, she's people watching, but at its worst, she's stalking mm-hmm. or being a voyeur. And
well,
there's
fantasizing
nothing about
too.
That. Well, fantasizing, I'll get to that. Yeah. There's nothing about looking at pictures of men that helps you learn how to be in relationship with them. There is nothing biblical or Christian about just judging people based on how they appear. I think, though, she knows this, and that's why she's asked the question, and that's why she's, you know, wanting some help. And so what to do? I mean, if she were to come to me and we were face-to-face, I would say, I really think you need to fast Facebook. Mm-hmm. You've got to take some time away to get some perspective, because you need the perspective to realize just how sick this is and just how unhealthy this is. And whatever time you were spending on Facebook, pour that into your brothers in Christ at church, actually being in friendship with them and actually spending time with other believers.
Sure. Yeah, that sounds good. Now, does it seem to you like she, I mean, how does someone become so unpracticed at this? I mean, is this like a personality kind of thing? Because she says she's too shy to have a conversation with a guy. What does she need to be doing proactively?
You know, yeah, I think that to your first question, how do you get to this place? It's not that hard in our culture, because kids grow up from a pretty young age now having access to this sort of social media, and it really does masquerade as relationship. And so you can feel like you're developing people skills, but you're not. And, you know, if you've ever had an online dating experience where you get to know a guy online and then you actually meet him in person, you realize really fast, wow, I didn't know him at all, and I feel like we're starting all the way back at, you know, ground zero. We have to go all the way back to the beginning and start over getting to know each other. And so the best place for her to start exercising these relationship muscles is going to be in a church, because there's going to be, if she's an active member of an evangelical church, she'll have some protection built in there, and hopefully it'll be the kind of body where, you know, it's brothers and sisters loving each other, and people will recognize that she's shy and help her with that, and she can ask for help. And so that's the best place to do it, because you're going to have people who are very forgiving and don't have really high expectations right away, but who also have a vested interest in helping her mature.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also I think help her turn kind of her eyes towards really what is real and what is feasible. I mean, it's not, obviously she's got to be friends with these guys on Facebook, but who are they really? Are they even potential, you know, suitors? It seems like she's kind of maybe wasting her time on what may not actually come to fruition. So,
exactly. And I mean, how many friends do you have on Facebook who are really complete strangers that you've never met in real life?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so it's possible that she's built up this whole fantasy world of men, and she might even think some of them are viable candidates, although it sounds like they don't pass her judgments very well. But, you know, when in reality, she doesn't even know where they live, and they, I mean, they may not even be who they say they are. There's just so much danger that is built into this, and you have to be so discerning. I'm not advocating that everybody do what I did and get off Facebook. I had very specific reasons for it, but if you are going to be there, I think you really need to pray for discernment and be a good steward of that media and not let it erode your ability to relate to real people.
Yeah, exactly. And I would say, too, I would just recommend an inbox that we did, it's several weeks ago now, where we really gave a girl some encouragement about what it looks like to be in a real relationship with someone and what it means to smile and say hello to someone, look him in the eye. You know, I think she needs to distinguish what is real from what isn't and start practicing, as you always say, you know, friendliness towards guys, the ones that really do have character, the ones that really are in your sphere, and start making those real relationships rather than settling for something that is not real.
Yeah, that's good. And one other thought comes to mind. We have some good friends who say that when they notice a bent in their children towards something like shyness or some other potentially antisocial behavior, they never say, well, that's just her personality. They always look for opportunities to require her to act contrary to her nature. So they will, you know, create opportunities for her to strain against her shyness and have to go into and do something uncomfortable, whether it's asking for change at the grocery store or, you know, going up to the library desk and asking for the hold, things that are very difficult for a shy individual. Mm-hmm. And so she might need to even seek out some help from a friend to say, hey, could you help me think of some ways that I can actually practice and learn how, just through repetition, how to be something other than what I currently am.
Yeah, sounds good. Okay, thank you, Candace.
You're welcome.
As always, everyone, write to us with your question, editor@boundless.org, so we can answer that in the future. And we will see you around here for the next show. Until then, I'm your host, Lisa Anderson, for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of boundless.org. Focus on the family.